This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Our lead story today comes with this subtitle: How many more stupid things can big banks do? Turns out, quite a few. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 7th of August. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good as always to have you with us. This has been, by just about any measure you care to use, a miserable, no good, flat out lousy year for global banks. JP Morgan lost $5 or $6 billion on trades gone bad over in London. Barclays got caught rigging LIBOR to the tune of $500 million fine and the hide of its CEO. Now, and I kid you not, it's money laundering. New York State has accused Britain's Standard Chartered Bank of covering up $250 billion worth of deals with Iran. And that is just the latest trespass. Last month, the British bank HSBC apologized for laundering Mexican drug money here in the States. In June, the Dutch bank ING paid $619 million for moving Iranian and Cuban money here. So with what one assumes is among the world's most sophisticated banking systems, why and how does that stuff happen here in the good old U.S. of A.? Marketplace's Sally Herships has the story.
Where do banksters, you know, bad guy bankers, want their money?
Think of it this way. Laundered money flows like water. It's going to flow to a course of least resistance, the weaker controlled countries in which there's money flowing.
That's Mark Williams. He teaches risk management at Boston University, and he's talking about the United States. Trillions of dollars flow through here, and it can be hard for regulators to catch everything. And criminals look for seemingly reputable banks to disguise their money. Kieran Beer is editor of MoneyLaundering.com.
You eventually have to go into the U.S. banking system to do the dollar transaction. So many things have to be done in dollars.
Drugs, weapons, oil.
There was a time when we thought maybe the euro would become the currency of the world and that the rest of the world could move away from its dependence on the dollar, but we've seen that hasn't gone so well.
Which Beer says makes getting dollars and getting into American financial markets really important for everyone, sanctioned countries like Iran included. He says the federal government has been pushing to tighten anti-money laundering laws, but then there are the states like Delaware, Nevada, and Alaska, where Beer says it's easy to register shell corporations with very little transparency.
And it's in the interest of states to say, just come on, bring us your money, do business with us, and we will not ask that many questions.
Like, why launder your money in the Cayman Islands when you can hide it in plain sight here? In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
We read a report this morning, you could call it an estimate or a guess, if you like, that about 15% of Mitt Romney's followers on Twitter are fakes, paid for fakes, as in you pay some company, they get you imaginary followers. Newt Gingrich had the same thing happen back in the primaries, and they're not the only ones. But honestly, the very idea just seemed so ridiculous to us that people would actually spend real money on Twitter followers that we had to have Adrian Hill check it out. Here you go.
As of this morning, I had 1,001 Twitter followers, which is nothing to crow about. And so when my editor said,
why don't you just go buy some followers? We'll give you $50.
I was pretty stoked. That is, until I started reporting the story.
Don't do it with your account.
What's the point?
That social media researcher Dan Zarella and Jan Zimmerman, author of Social Media Marketing for Dummies. And here's social media expert Dave Kirpin.
it is nice on the ego. That's the reality. But ultimately, you know, if they're not going to be actually interacting with you and actually doing something when you tweet, what does that really mean?
Also, it turns out Twitter's rules forbid buying followers from a third party under penalty of permanent suspension. So no bot fame for me. But those worries haven't stopped other people. Here's Kirpin again.
I think that it's more common than some people think.
If you Google buy Twitter followers, you'll find dozens of companies and eBay sellers offering the service, most offering fully faked accounts. Research from Barracuda Labs finds the average cost is about $18 for 1,000. But do they really help a brand? Probably not much. Jan Zimmerman says there can be an endorsement effect.
If this many people think they're wonderful, then I should think they're wonderful too, and I should agree to follow them.
But she says real followers who actually care what you have to say are much more important for success. I'm at Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
And we are at Marketplace APM, you know, should you want to follow us. $50 invested the right way on Wall Street today instead of on Twitter followers. Might have made you some money. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. People who help people who get laid off are getting laid off. More people finding work where there are jobs to be found means fewer workers are needed in state unemployment offices. Jim Gibbons has worked for the Michigan Unemployment Office since 2009, and after an announcement a week or so ago, he too is waiting to hear whether he is going to join the ranks of the unemployed as well. Mr. Gibbons, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you for letting me be on.
What's the mood then at the unemployment office? I mean, are people, you know, scared about losing their jobs?
Oh, yeah. I mean, a couple of Mondays ago, we were told about halfway through the day that the agency is looking at close to 400 personnel being cut from the agency.
It does kind of make you shake your head at the irony, though, right? The unemployment office having to lay people off because there's not enough unemployed people?
Well, the email did explain that they've got a house to get back in order.
Before you got to work in the unemployment office, what did you do for a living?
Well, for the past 25 years, leading up until June 2008, I was with the automotive industry, first GM and then Ford.
Were you by chance laid off yourself?
I was permanently laid off. In fact, I was retired from Visteon Corporation in June 2008.
Well, so you've reinvented yourself, once now, sir? How many times can you do it, do you think?
Well, actually, this is probably reinvention number two, because my last 2 years at Visteon, I had to reinvent myself as a machine shop worker, and I did that. I was able to do that successfully for 2 years when finally my number came up.
Yeah, but, you know, it's interesting because that's what all the politicians say you have to do, right? We have to retrain people. We have to give them the skills to get back to work. And here you went and found the skills, and you got a job, and now it's on the line again.
Unfortunately, you're correct. It's on the line again. I was able to acquire new skills and have done a pretty good job of it. And now I may be facing a layoff.
You know, as lousy as things have been in the state of Michigan unemployment-wise, they're better now, right? I mean, I imagine your workload was going down at the unemployment office.
The unemployment office workload has gone down almost, it's probably close to, it's probably maybe 25% of what it was. It's a good thing, but, you know, again, a lot of those people may be no longer collecting because they've run out of benefit weeks.
Jim Gibbons, he works at the Michigan State Unemployment Office. He may or may not lose his job come September because fewer people are out of work in the state of Michigan. Mr. Gibbons, thanks very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Leave it to Americans to take a good idea just that additional step too far. Not long ago, hotels in Paris started keeping bees on their roofs, kind of a farm-to-table local food feature for the hotel's restaurants. Now, here, it's a marketing tool. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith scaled the heights of a landmark Manhattan hotel to get this story for us.
I'm standing on the roof of the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in Midtown Manhattan, holding my microphone up to the entrance of one of six wooden beehives. There are about 300,000 bees in these hives, which I'm trying not to think about. David Garcelon is the executive chef at the Waldorf. It was his idea to put the bees here, and he's been incorporating the honey into the hotel's food.
You know, we get a great ingredient from it, and it's a great story for our guests.
The Waldorf expects to harvest about 800 pounds of honey a year. Its restaurants use about 1,000 pounds a year.
I'll just put a little bit on this spoon.
Mmm. Oh, that's really, really good.
You get a bit of herbal, kind of minty. We think that that's from, there's a lot of linden trees in New York in the spring.
Garcelon has started adding the honey to salad dressing, roast chicken, creme brulee. It's not all milk and honey, though. The bees can swarm out of their hives, they sometimes get into the rooms, and people have been stung. But the Waldorf sees these bees as a way to make the grand dame of New York hotels appeal to a younger luxury traveler.
We want to reintroduce the Waldorf to the next generation.
Matt Zolby is the director of sales and marketing at the Waldorf. He says the bees appeal to health-conscious, environmentally conscious guests who want an experience, not just a swanky room.
People want to be someplace where something happened, that something is extraordinary. Otherwise, we are a commodity, a widget.
Zolby says the Waldorf plans to offer hive tours and tastings and sell jars of the honey. It's launched a social media campaign around the bees and plans to let Facebook fans vote on names for the hives.
For example, we would have Empire State of Hive, and maybe Alicia Bees would be the queen bee in that hive.
Stacy Small is the president of Elite Travel International. She says hotels are competing like mad for a shrinking pool of high-end travelers. And these days, those travelers want authentic, be it homegrown honey or other rustic behind-the-scenes experiences.
I was at the Metropole in Hanoi recently, and they had us meet with the executive chef and then going by taxi to the local market with her and watching her bargain and then come back and getting a cooking lesson with her.
Small says hotels are trying to create a contemporary Kodak moment, so guests post pictures of their hive tour or market excursion on Facebook or Twitter.
One photo that they take of something really cool going on at the hotel could lead to 10 more of their friends calling me to book that hotel.
Oh, the value of buzz. On the roof of the Waldorf Astoria, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
The value of buzz. That was pretty good. I like that. Get it? Buzz and the bees. All right. Anyway, I've been in Washington the past couple of days working on some other stuff. And I have to tell you, there is a certain lull in town, what with Congress being on vacation. They don't have to be back to the Capitol and back work until after Labor Day, which got commentator Robert Reich wondering what would happen if we all got some extra time off.
Here's an idea I offer free of charge to any candidate running for office this fall. Propose that every American get a mandatory minimum of 3 weeks paid vacation a year. Most Americans only get 2 weeks off right now, but many don't even take it all out of fear of losing their jobs. One in four gets no paid vacation at all, not even holidays. Overall, Americans have less vacation time than workers in any other advanced economy. This is absurd. A mandatory 3 weeks off would be good for everyone, including employers. Studies show workers who take time off are more productive after their batteries are recharged, they have higher morale, and are less likely to mentally check out on the job. This means more output per worker, enough to compensate employers for the cost of hiring additional workers to cover for everyone's 3 weeks vacation time. It's also a win for the economy, because these additional workers would bring down the level of unemployment and put more money into more people's pockets. This extra purchasing power would boost the economy overall. More and longer vacations would also improve our health. A study by Wisconsin's Marshfield Clinic shows women who take regular vacations experience less tension and depression year-round. Studies also show that men who take regular vacations have less heart disease and fewer heart attacks. Better health is not just good for us as individuals. It also translates into more productive workers, fewer sick days, less absenteeism, and lower health care costs. In other words, a 3-week minimum vacation is a win-win-win. Good for workers, good for employers, and good for the economy. And I guarantee it would also be a winner among voters. Governor Romney, President Obama, you listening?
When he's not on vacation, Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His most recent book is called Beyond Outrage. Share your thoughts with us, if you like, Facebook, Twitter, at Marketplace APM, as I said before, or good old-fashioned email letters at marketplace.org, whatever works for you. Coming up, oh, for the days of summer gone by.
I've got a quickie weekend. I can go to one of the local mountain resorts.
How those resorts are adapting. But first, let's do the numbers. Well, let's see. The Dow Industrials picked up 51 points today, nearly 0.4%, closed at 13,168. The NASDAQ tacked on 25 points, about 0.9%, 3015, 3015. The numbers there, the S&P 500 grew 7 points, 0.5%, 1401. Its first close above 1400, by the by, in 3 months. Energy stocks in particular helped fuel the surge on the S&P. Shares of Chesapeake Energy burned brighter by almost 9.5% today on better than expected quarterly earnings. Higher quarterly profits gave Tenet Healthcare a shot in the arm. Shares of the hospital operator perked up 9% today on word it's treating more patients. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.62%. And you are listening to... Wait, what's the name of the show? Oh, yeah, Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The Labor Department releases its preliminary productivity and costs report for the second quarter. The Airline Pilots Association International convenes its annual Air Safety Forum in Washington. And Academy Award-winning actor Dustin Hoffman turns 75. Happy birthday. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Here with a more human window than we usually get into the realities of the present economy. The NAE Casey Foundation says that 1 in 3 children in this country are in families where neither parent has a full-time, year-round job, and that that situation does things to those kids and to their prospects. From the Wealth and Poverty Desk and Michigan Radio, Dustin Dwyer has the story.
Ronnie Coulter can't tell you much about the recession. She's more interested in her mom's phone.
Oh, no. This is Mommy. This is Mommy.
Officially, Ronnie, whose full name is Veronica, was born after the recession. But her mom, LaManda Coulter, has bounced around from job to job for Ronnie's entire life. Not even for the typical recession reasons. When Ronnie was 10 months old, LaManda had to leave her job.
It was just, I couldn't find daycare.
At least not daycare she could afford.
So I just had to stay home and try to find ways to support me and my baby.
Coulter did her friend's hair for cash. She signed up for assistance from the state. She moved in with family. But even after getting the daycare situation fixed, Coulter has been bouncing between temp jobs, which is stressful.
Because every time I lose a job, I be in a bad mood the whole day. To the point where I'm stressing people out around me. You need to take me to the place to go fill applications right now.
It's true that the recession affected everyone in America, rich and poor, but some groups were hit worse. People with no college degree, African Americans. But another group that was hit hard is kids. Ariel Khalil is a public policy professor at the University of Chicago.
So, at present, about a quarter of children under the age of 6 are living below the official poverty line.
That line comes in at a combined income of $23,000 for a family of 4. Slipping into poverty is just one of the risks for kids when their parents lose a job. Khalil says kids in this situation are more likely to have behavior problems, they're more likely to be held back a grade, and that can hurt their chances of getting into college, even years after the parent went back to work.
I think we need to think about the recession and job loss and unemployment in general as a two-generation problem.
LaManda Coulter is working hard to make sure that's not the case for her daughter.
If you got to get a temp job, get it. You know, by all means necessary, do it.
Coulter has been bouncing around with these temp jobs for a while. Now she's working in a factory that makes parts for heavy-duty trucks. She's getting good hours, and there's potential for permanent work. She's looking into getting her own apartment. She's paying down her debts.
I'm seeing a little progress because at first I was working and I couldn't get nothing paid off. You know, so it felt good for me to go in and pay $500 worth of bills off.
The ultimate goal is to go to college and to start her own business. And maybe Ronnie won't even remember what it's like to see her mom struggle. In Grand Rapids, Michigan, I'm Dustin Dwyer for Marketplace.
It can be such a shame when a relationship goes downhill, don't you think? When what we all thought was a match made in heaven crumbles before our very eyes. Lest you think we've turned the broadcast over to the editors of Us Weekly, I'm talking here, people, about Apple and Google. A couple of months ago, Apple said it's going to boot Google Maps when its new operating system comes out later this year. As of last night, we found out YouTube is going to be disappeared from iPods and iPads and iPhones as well. Marketplace's Queen of Kim has the latest on high tech's biggest breakup.
Not too long ago, Apple and Google were sweethearts. There was Apple, so sleek, stylish, and popular. And Google, wow, does she have some brains on her. She knows everything on the web, and she's got Maps and YouTube. Eric Goldman is the director of the High Tech Law Institute at Santa Clara University. He says it was a classic case of opposites attract.
Apple coming out of a hardware manufacturing environment, Google coming out of content, and for a long time they were complementary.
Sarah Rotman-Epps is an analyst at Forrester Research, and she says, like so many relationships, it was an affair that broke them up. In this case, Google acquired Android, a mobile operating system, and it now runs on more than half the smartphones in the world. Epps says from Apple's perspective,
I woke up and I don't even recognize you anymore. You know, the relationship that we used to have is no longer what we thought it was.
Google makes money by being on Apple. By some estimates, about 40% of Google's mobile revenues will come from Apple this year. And to add insult to injury, some of that money, presumably, goes to funding Android. So that raises a question. Now that Apple has kicked Google Maps and YouTube off its mobile operating system, is Google Search next? Carolina Milanese is an analyst at Gartner. She says, probably not.
I think at the end of the day, it's all about making sure that they don't upset their users.
Because right now, consumers love Google Search. And divorce aside, you have to do what's right for the kids. Right? I'm Queen of Kim for Marketplace.
The modern summer vacation can be pretty much anything. A trip overseas, a week at home just hanging out. Or what vacations in a way used to be. Holidays built around what you might call the traditional model. Small resort towns that rely on families in the summertime to keep going. Resort towns that are also struggling to keep pace right now. Marketplace's Eve Tro took a drive up to Lake Arrowhead, California to check things out.
This scene's been repeated every summer for 66 years.
Keep those arms straight, buddy.
A tan, muscled instructor jumps in the water with a pale, skinny kid at Mackenzie's water ski school. The kid wobbles and shakes, then stands up.
Yeah.
As he speeds away, another boat pulls in. Tammy Reeves holds up her iPhone to capture the moment.
My daughter Amanda and my son David are water skiing for the first time. How old are you?
7 and a half.
How was it?
Really fun.
They've been here a week, rented a house near the lake.
We're going to go grab some brunch up here as a family and head back to Orange County.
That's about 2 hours drive away. Lake Arrowhead was designed for just this kind of escape from L.A., says longtime resident Andy Center.
People developed this area in the teens and 20s for that huge growing population, not just the city of L.A., but the region.
Center runs AAA Vacation Rentals, the first building you see driving into Lake Arrowhead Village. Its white turret and brown beams match the Bavarian air of everything else nestled in the pines. His office was the headquarters, where one company sold thousands of lots for vacation homes.
Or even campsites. They actually sold lots that are for tents.
Compare that to the multi-million dollar fortresses that circle the lake today. The ones the tour guide points out aboard the Lake Arrowhead Queen.
Patch of grass to the left, that's their driving range.
He's careful not to mention current owners' names. A lot of real estate has gone up for sale here since the recession, mansions and modest cabins alike. Andy Center says that's piled on to another trend he's seen in vacation rentals, shorter stays. He chalks that up to cheaper airfares.
People tend to take their week-long or longer vacations to more distant places, and they focus more, okay, I've got a quickie weekend, I can go to one of the local mountain resorts.
Local marketing expert Leslie McClellan met me at a lakeside breakfast spot. She says not only did visitors used to stay longer, they'd plan further ahead.
People booked like months in advance. The lodging people would get, you know, minimum three-night stays. I mean, people talk about the good old days, and that's what they're talking about.
Today, it's hard to know who's coming up the hill, as the locals say, or when. High season runs from about July 4th to mid-August, instead of Memorial Day to Labor Day. Leslie McClellan used to place magazine and newspaper ads for the Chamber of Commerce to promote the lake. When that money ran dry, she used free social media tools. Now she's laid off.
There's been no marketing this year.
That may not bode well for the empty retail spaces in Lake Arrowhead Village, but it doesn't mean the lake is empty. Boys still fish from canoes, girls still perch on diving boards, parents still wait with towels to dry them off. Jared and Kelly Mueller watch their two sons feed the ducks.
I think for a family to get to know each other, you need to have things quiet. So we like to come up to a place where my cell phone doesn't work and the boys can run around, make bows and arrows and get dirty.
They're camping a few miles away from the lake. When they pack up, they'll drive back to their home near Disneyland. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
We're adding jobs, as we learned last Friday, and the housing industry is picking up. So there's a case to be made that the economy is stronger than it might appear at first glance. But one industry is starting to see some downward trending sales, the once lucrative beach ball business. We sent the news team from the online comedy site Funny or Die to figure out what's going on.
Bouncing beach balls. You've probably seen the classic striped variety being bandied about in the park, at the ball game, and of course, at the beach. It's America's pastime. But lately, the beach ball industry is in trouble. Big trouble.
Yeah, around Memorial Day, we were selling 20, 25 balls a day. But in the last week, it's really slowed down.
This local merchant describes what's happening around the country, prompting some to ask, has the beach ball bubble burst?
Yeah, we're selling so few beach balls. I think we're going to have to give up that shelf space to pens and paper and backpacks because those things are selling a lot more right now.
It appears the beach ball boom has gone bust while backpacks are suddenly selling like backpacks filled with hotcakes. Perhaps it's just a sign that our economy is unstable and unpredictable. But for now, one of the world's favorite sandy funtime beach traditions is in jeopardy of being washed away. Like a beach ball sometimes gets washed away in the surf at the beach.
The work of Lauren Palmigiano, Danny Jelenic, and Ryan Perez from Funny or Die. There is more online at funnyordie.com.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, an economic indicator courtesy of Kraft. Here's a quote from the food conglomerate's latest earnings report. Gum, it says, continues to be weak. Sales growth has slowed in developing countries. And it goes on, and this is a quote, gum is unlikely to return to its historical growth rates in the near term. So, hey, never let it be said we don't cover the whole economy for you. All right, we got to go. Thanks to Mary Dew and John Haas and Justin Ho on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abeed. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Back home tomorrow in Los Angeles. Hope you can join us from there. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.